Okay, we're back on the road. Commissioner Dawson.
Mr. Barr, your grounds for rejecting this zoning rezoning submission come down to infrastructure in the end, don't they? That's your sort of where you sort of reached your bottom line in terms
yes.
of whether or not the zoning should occur. I mean, I know
yes.
you've got other concerns and you've been through those, but in the end, it's infrastructure that's caused you to recommend declining. So I'm going to ask you about a couple of other concerns that were raised by the council's witnesses, Ms. Gilbert and Ms. Hampson. And I just want to see why you've got to a more positive point, I suppose, in considering those issues. Talking about Ms. Gilbert, her issue, the concerns we discussed with her were about the effect on the character of Hawea Township, of a growth of this scale. I'm just going to try and find my notes from here. And I think what I've written that Ms. Gilbert sort of said as to where she came to is that she's taken the domain acres approval and the approval of the SHA as part of her existing environment and said that on the basis of the fact that in her mind is already there and will happen, the horse is bolted on that side of Cemetery Road, and in terms of the effect on the change of character of Hawea, and the change to the character of Hawea has, or in her case will happen with that level of development of domain acres in the SHA, and so the incremental change, I think she said it's just sort of filling in the gaps, was her words, which it isn't really, it's quite a bit bigger than that. But she said, well, it's too late, we may as well make a nice organic sort of defensible boundary south of, rather than down at the water race. You've already said in answer to a question from the chair that SHA doesn't really form part of our existing environment under the RMA. It's not there as an RMA feature. It may or may not happen. It's under a different legislation. So, but you seem to have accepted Ms. Gilbert's, or have come to a similar opinion to Ms. Gilbert, that this isn't an effect on the change to the character of how we are that should stand in the way of going down to the water race. So given that she predicated what she said on the basis of an SHA, and now you're saying, well, actually, no, we're just talking about domain acres, and which is a rural residential or rural lifestyle zone.
Rural residential.
Which is, yeah.
We
know we've got concerns from the community of Hawea. We know that the Timsfield area, that area on the flat, I mean, that is definitely there down to Cemetery Road. There's the UGB, urban growth, yes, is at Cemetery Road. That's supported by the community. What is your opinion on the impact of this growth on the character of how we are now? And just if I could just pause for a moment, I know I'm putting some things to you, but it interrelates to my concerns, the concern expressed by Ms. Hampson. So what Ms. Hampson said is, well, what she seemed to be saying is there's no need for this. There's no need to do this in terms of the housing capacity. So, I mean, I know I'm sort of interpreting what she's saying, but she sort of said, so if there's no need, do we not need to be a bit cautious about accepting the costs? I think that's what she said. You know, there are costs, and one of those costs is this change to the character of Hawea now. So shouldn't we be a bit cautious about accepting the costs when the benefits are not that clear? Or certainly not, there isn't a particular benefit at the moment, is what she said. And she discounted the competition type benefit.
Mm.
So given that there's not really a benefit, or certainly not a strong benefit in terms of need, there is a cost at the moment identified, even by Ms. Gilbert, to the character of Hawea.
Mm.
And but you've said that's not an issue, it's only infrastructure. And I want you to rethink, think about that and tell us where you've got to. Or
well, it probably sounds trite, but it is my collective planning view as to the merits of the proposal overall. And what I've leaned on there is Chapter 4, as well as taking advice from the respective technical experts. It comes back to my interpretation of Chapter 4 as it's been amended through the consent order that's been filed. It also comes back to my...
You're going to have to tell us which bits of Chapter 4.
I don't have the consent order varied version of Chapter 4 in front of me, but one thing that's... I did include one particular policy in my evidence, which which the Chair talked about, which relates to the amendments to that policy around... I'll go back to page...
It's no longer demand-related.
No, the policy 4.2.2.23, I think, is no longer related to demand and comes back to a strong justification being required when it's proven that there is demand. And I think in terms of the entertaining an extension to the Hawea Township, it stacks up on its merits only to the extent that I've supported it in terms of to the water race. And that is really being guided there by Chapter 4 and Chapter 6 of the PDP. That's also taking Ms. Gilbert's advice as to the sensitivities of the rural character landscape and the rural zone landscape. It's my own unqualified understanding of the soil types and the potential loss of soils. And it's also, in balancing Chapters 4 and Chapter 6 and the costs through Chapter 21 of losing a productive soil resource, it's sort of balancing the, you know, I concur with Ms. Hampson where perhaps the submitters could be not criticised but could be claimed to be overstating the benefits in terms of increasing housing supply through another additional developers and additional markets and additional lots being brought to the market in a greenfield context, which is going to happen sooner and in probably chunks compared to the infill that's going to happen under the low density suburban residential existing Lake Hawea Township. So if there's a criticism that they're overly reliant, that the submitter's overly reliant on that, perhaps there's also a criticism that, which I said in my rebuttal, that even though there's no need to extend, it's not a reason under the RMA to reject the development or a resource consent or a rezoning. It comes back to that plans framework. So in my view, the NPS isn't designed to, certainly not designed to stop development or to preclude development if there is sufficient capacity, but nor in my view is that document designed to provide for housing business over and above other costs, and that's set out fairly clearly in the preamble to that document.
Yes, I think what Ms. Hampson, what I took from what she was saying is that the fact that there's no need is not a reason to say, well, that of its own should prevent development. It just means that there's no clear and immediate benefit to be weighed against the costs.
those costs.
And so really it comes down to what are the costs.
Yes.
And you're saying, well, it's not really a loss of soils, that's not a big cost. So the costs come down to an earlier change in character to how we are than would happen if we waited till there was more need.
That's right.
Given that this is the direction that it would have to go on in the future if that need arose, if and when that need arose.
Yes, so that's right. And those sometimes depending on the need, if the costs are higher in terms of it being a more sensitive landscape resource or in terms of being a bigger change and a more jarring change to the existing character and nature and scale of the town it's extending or branching off from, then those costs are higher. But the way I've interpreted the respective advice from the technical experts is that when those costs are sort of balanced or distilled under chapters 4 and 6 of the PDP in particular, that urban extension at this time could be appropriate.
Can I just ask, you've drawn our attention appropriately to that change in that Chapter 4 policy, basically removing focus on need, making it much more open. What about the Chapter 4 policy relating to community, I've forgotten how it's worded, but you know, community expressions of future direction?
I'm just looking for it. I'm looking for I've got the consent order version and it only includes the changes, so it doesn't include the changes that aren't amended. But that will be in the PDP folder, which is here. So policy, Upper Clutha policy 4.2.2.22. So it says define the urban growth boundaries for Wanaka and Lake Harbour Township as shown on the district plan maps that, and then Lim C says
community support as expressed through strategic community planning processes.
Oh, so because the consent order doesn't include all of the.
That's right. Oh. Yeah, it might benefit the panel to put together a consolidated version.
That was attached to someone's.
We can do that quite easily.
When I come.
So
this is what we're talking about.
What's that?
Commissioner?
Oh, sorry. What?
That's what we're talking about. 4.2.22.
Yes, I'm sorry, I've got it. So is 4.2.22 the same as it was in the consolidated version?
Yes.
Define urban growth boundaries based on existing urbanised areas. Have community support.
So basically, how does it stack up against 4.2.2.22?
Well, it would achieve Lim A because it is based on an existing urbanised area. It assists without forensically examining Lim B, it assists with implementing Lim B, and even if the existing, let's say, council-initiated capacity through Stage 3 easily said LIMBYs met throughout Hawea individually and the wider Wanaka ward. LIMBY doesn't tell you to stop development. LIMBY, it...
Like, yeah, because like LIMBYs, like the NPS, it says it must be at least as big enough.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say how much bigger, effectively.
Yes. So LIMC, there's clearly a tension there, and the Hawea Community Association would be quick to remind parties involved with that. So the Hawea 2020 document as it stands, which is the council, as far as I'm aware, it's in terms of a council sort of local government act initiated community plan. That's what we have. I think it's dated 2003.
So what about the Hawea Growth Review 2015?
And also the
it's one of the documents I've asked.
Upper Tooth and Mapping section of the PDP, which went to an established UGB.
That as well. Now, Commissioner, the Hawea Growth Review 2015, I'm not familiar with that.
Someone mentioned it somewhere, and I said, it's on our list of...
There was a submission made by a planning consultant for the Hawea Community Association as part of the notified plan in 2015. If that's the document, that's not a council document. Yeah.
We'll find out when we
And yes, Commissioner, there is the council's position in the hearings panel's recommendations on adding an urban growth boundary to Hawea and considering issues there.
I mean, that's one of my, through that process, there was community support for that urban growth boundary, and that was referenced back to the 2020 process that we referred to as the community perception. One of my concerns is that at that point, Cemetery Road was identified, and the street property, which is the far end, which is the rural res, was often cited during the discussions of the SHA process as being, well, it's already crossed. The SHA, which is now not recognised under the RMA, is being cited again as, well, the horse is bolted. And if you literally look at the potential of the urban growth boundary that's been suggested, which is the waterways, what's sticking below that is that little blue triangle. So the concern for me is that, or one of my major concerns is that in some future discussion, some person can reasonably suggest it's already been breached. And then it comes down to what is a defensible edge.
Yes, well, that comes down to the strength of the edge itself and the policy framework that supports that. And at the moment, the council's initial inquiry, at least physically, is that the existing urban growth boundary isn't particularly strong. And what we're faced with now is a proposal to extend that and perhaps have an opportunity to instate an urban growth boundary that is strong and legible and defendable. The alternative the council would have, and this probably wouldn't be the council as a planning or consenting authority, but the council broadly would be to perhaps undertake the other recommendation in the Gilbert landscape report that's attached to section 32, which would be to sort of augment the existing urban growth boundary to create something that's physically has more presence physically. But at the moment, before the council could perhaps action that, it's dealing with this submission.
Before you go on, can I ask Mr. Barr to go to E? Does this avoid sprawling and sporadic urban development across the rural areas of the basin?
I think my recommendation would not constitute sprawling development. I think that the full extent of the rezoning sought would be sprawling development, potentially in the context of the size of Lake Hawea Township. And especially in the context of the treatment, or perhaps a lack of treatment, of the urban growth boundary where the resource consent SHA area is the eastern boundary. And the weaker, perhaps the sort of, physically anyway, at least the sort of narrower boundary up along the street or the main acres land.
Okay, so we started with me interrupting Commissioner, Commissioner McLeod interrupted me, but so should we go back to Commissioner Dawson and Holmes?
Absolutely.
Right. So I think I understand, mostly understand, how you came to your overall conclusion, particularly looking at the policy direction in Chapter 4 and, I think, did you say 6, but yeah, to a certain extent 6. But just when, I suppose, to conclude the discussion about effects on the character of Hawea, do I understand that your opinion to be that even if we don't take account of the SHA being in existence,
mm-hmm.
and therefore ignore that part of Ms. Gilbert's interpretation, I think as a planner you can have an opinion on effects on character of an urban area.
Thank you.
It's my view, so I'm asking you, if you ignore the SHA, what is your opinion about the effect on the character of Hawea of an extension now to the water race?
I think the cost is low relative to the benefits. And I say that because from a planning perspective, the area is relatively homogeneous in terms of the nature and type of urban development that's directly on the northern side of Cemetery Road. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, but if you ask me the question and the argument was as to the urban edge, perhaps at the top of the moraine, I might be giving you a different answer if there's no development on
yes.
the downward
so
side of that moraine. But I think in terms of how that would read, how that extension would read overall, I see it up the water race with the controls that I'm recommending. I'd see it as relatively logical and considered extension to the township.
Yes, so really it's not a matter that of the SHA going across the road already that affects, influences your opinion about the change in character. It's the fact that it's already gone onto the flat below the moraine in the area north of Cemetery Road.
Which yes,
is
and there's
an extensive area.
Yes, yeah. And there's nothing, despite it being a road and predominantly being farmland on the southern side of that road, there's nothing distinguishable or strong enough about Cemetery Road in and of itself to retain that as the edge.
And that was Ms. Gilbert's view through the Section 32 landscape report as well, wasn't it? Well, it wasn't
yes.
a strong boundary.
Yes, that's right. And there's the alternative to augment it or to consider. Her brief was to consider, well, if that's not that strong, is there something available?
And then you say cost is low relative to the benefits?
Yes.
So what are the benefits?
Well, the benefits are an increase in the supply of housing.
Yeah. Irrespective of the strong need, it just adds to the
it adds
of housing.
Yes, that's right. I mean, and it comes back to my rebuttal where I generally agree with Mr. Williams. I don't agree with Mr. Williams and the submitter's economic expert that the council's housing capacity assessments and the way the council has gone about its review in stage 3 is underwhelming or insufficient. But I do agree with them that in terms of the NPS, that the NPS doesn't say you need to stop just because you've achieved those targets. The NPS UDC is to make sure councils meet those.
Yeah, I understand that, but you've still got to have a benefit.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
You could
yeah.
zone
yep.
forever,
yep.
And the benefits were starting to run out. Yeah, but you still see there is a benefit in having this additional area available to housing over and above what the PDP provides for.
Yes, I do, and I think it comes back to the housing benefit and the concept of a greenfield, the addition of a dedicated greenfield housing supply.
Yes, when most of the housing, well, when a significant proportion of the housing, additional housing provided for in Hawea is through upzoning.
Yes. There are some quite large greenfields or undeveloped sites in Hawea Township, but...
It's about half and half, I think. Okay, so now I'll just go on to my next topic.
Sure.
You haven't, in 346, as I understand it, you haven't included the upgrade of the intersection of the Hawea control structure, the main road and Capel Avenue, as part of the infrastructure that you think needs to be contributed to by this development. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Why?
Which corner are we talking about? Sorry.
Up at the dam.
Oh yes, the dam corner.
Below the pump.
It's because to me, from reading Mr. Smith's evidence and from my understanding of the proposal, that there's a clear and distinguishable infrastructure burden placed on the intersection of Cemetery and Domain Road, but I can't say the same for the intersection you just asked me at Capel Ave and the Hawea Control Structure Road. And the reason for that is attributable to the existing and also the zoned development at Lake Hawea, the Lake Hawea Township low density suburban residential zone.
So in terms of the vehicle numbers, the pressure on that intersection is as much if not more from the existing development as opposed to being aggravated by this new development.
Correct.
So if I could just take you back up to 344 in your evidence, which is a sort of more of an introductory paragraph about the roading. I just couldn't understand what you're saying here, I'm sorry. I consider the identified road network effects and necessary upgrades can be distinguishable from other anticipated development in the Hawea area. I consider the matters identified that should be linked to the subdivision and development of the zoning, it should be accepted. It's the next sentence that I couldn't understand. And so that any costs associated to specific... I can't... Just tell me what you say.
Okay. In this case, often when, let's say, the council choose to support a rezoning, it, depending on the nature and scale of the rezoning or its location, you know, even if it is a greenfield extension, it can sort of say, well, that the effects of that are part of the mix of all the other things happening and all the other growth, and so therefore you can't identify that development as a single cause, and we're going to, if it gets rezoned, then the council will have to plan for an upgrade, put it in its long-term plan and its annual plan and deal with it. But because this development's quite large, the greenfield development, and that's why I've, for want of a better word, pinned that development to those particular intersection and roading, all those infrastructure upgrades as well, and I was sort of reconciling that in this case, my recommendation to the council or to the hearings panel is to not let it be absorbed as part of the generalised annual plan, whatever gets on the priority list for the annual plan or long-term plan and infrastructure upgrades. And I think I need to put my recommendation is that particular policies and rules are added into the district plan associated with this subdivision, with this rezoning and the consequent subdivision that would make sure that those upgrades happen.
All right, no, I do understand now. So in general, you're saying that these infrastructure upgrades and the cost of them are distinguishable to this
yes.
growth area and should be specifically provided for and not just to be left
yes.
to be part of, except for that intersection at the dam.
Yes.
Where you think that because of where it is and how it relates to the existing area, should be absorbed in the council's
yes.
general growth strategy
yes.
rather than being pinned to this development.
Yes, and I haven't considered sort of particular design-related costs and benefits of that versus the cost of what a roundabout would be down there versus the, in, as Mr. Smith identified, because of the because of the sort of steep engineered
yeah.
nature of that, that might be physically much more complex, which means expensive. It's really just the reason why I've distinguished between those two is because I just think one's a lot more readily available to be associated with the proposed rezoning.
Closer and
yeah.
more specifically related
yeah.
to that locality. Yeah. All right, that's good. Thank you very much for clarifying that.
Before you go on, is there an issue about the ability to undertake it at all arising from that? Mr. Roster was raising that there's just physically not enough room
is
for a suitably sized roundabout.
Is this the Keppel Ave or the main road?
At Keppel.
Well, that's something I guess in time a roading engineer will need to tell the council. I think it's also the complexity of the embankment on one side and the how we, you know, what has clearly been engineered for the purposes of the integrity of the dam, for want of a better word. And Mr. Smith's, and I understand Mr. Smith's concerns related to, obviously, if you're going to effectively claim land over that, and it will have the effect of being, you know, having a surcharge on whatever the embankment is, there might just be a lot more to it than just taking some land and retaining it. It might have an effect on the integrity of that structure, but neither I nor Mr. Smith are engineers, so we can't really take it much further than that. But it is constrained physically, as is, I understand, the land at Cemetery Road and Domain Road at the moment as well.
I suppose that what I understood Mr. Rossiter to be saying to us that was that there was an issue as to whether it was even possible.
Maybe. Yes, maybe.
And if that were, if, like, I'll have to go back and reread my notes of his evidence, but if my recollection is correct, what if any impact should that have on we're not decision makers, but on our decision making process?
Well, it could have quite a bearing, but there's not sufficient information by anybody saying that it's either not feasible. So I don't think there's sufficient information to make a conclusion that it's not feasible at all to provide some sort of intersection improvement.
Yes, I think Mr. Roster was probably not going so far as to say it's definitely not possible, but there's an issue as to whether it's possible. I think that would probably be a better characterisation of what he said.
Mm.
I'll need to read my notes, and which is obviously in a different category. So,
yeah, no, I think it came back to it wasn't Mr. Smith's evidence. It was Mr. Rossiter sort of said that as well, because the land isn't. It's not that land isn't council land, and it's Contact Energy have an interest in it in terms of the integrity of that structure. Perhaps that's a complicating factor too, but can't really take that much further without having any sort of technical evidence or information about that.
So I suppose what's your advice as to, like, accepting that there is a degree of uncertainty extent at large, but there is a degree of uncertainty as to whether there is a solution. What if any impact should that have on our reasoning and decision making process?
I think I'm just thinking about this in the context of the council's proposed zoning as well. Um, I think it's prudent to obviously accept Mr. Rossiter's advice there, that there could be some real constraints.
So it's sort of, does it go with the infrastructure basket, that there are constraints on the sewage and water supply as well?
Yes. Yes.
Which must, you know, the council zoning, upzoning, and rezoning must go to those,
yes,
touching on those constraints as well.
Yes, they will as well from a network perspective.
Yes,
yes.
But Mr. Powell's evidence is that the scale of this growth just tips it over into the, well, we haven't planned for this at all department.
Yes, that's right.
And presumably the aggravation of maybe even an existing or about to happen concern at that Capital Ave Domain Road dam intersection could be similar.
Yes, that's fair.
Greater certainty from Mr. Powell than Mr. Rossiter. Mr. Rossiter was saying it was a possibility. I think Mr. Powell was somewhat more definite.
That there definitely is a problem.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. Mr. Rossiter's saying
there
may be a problem because the size of an intersection required for the total development is getting quite big and there just isn't much land there.
That's right. And it's more about the implication as to the design of the proposed district plan, and that if you have a subdivision with a structure plan and your subdivision proposal is consistent with the structure plan, it's a controlled activity, and so the effects of that development should be, in my view, sort of contemplated by the plan, and so you shouldn't have a fundamental conversation about whether or not if an intersection upgrade can happen at all at flowing from a controlled activity.
Well, that's just what the chairman's indicating.
That's right.
That's really where I got to too, having heard from Mr. Rossiter. I think, well, this might be able to happen, or it might be a 20-year program to sort out
things with right.
Contact.
There could be other technical solutions, but I'm not a traffic engineer, so I'm not going to put them to me.
Yeah,
but
just like there might be to sewage and water, but we have no idea what they are. They're not
planned
for, they're not budgeted for.
And any engineer will tell you that there's a technical solution, it's just how much you're prepared to pay for it.
Okay, so my next questions start getting into the provisions.
I wonder if we should take our colleagues' questions before you go into the provisions.
Okay. Can I just turn to the paragraph that I've marked here? yes. Yep. I'm getting into the how do you put the SHA into the provisions. So let's get the other questions more on a more general matter.
I have no further questions, just to endorse the questions that have already been asked. I would have been the same ones I would have asked.
Commissioner McLeod?
Yeah, well, can I push you a little bit more on defensible edge and urban growth boundaries? Urban growth boundaries, notwithstanding the fact that I have reviewed the consolidated version for a while, but if I could borrow someone's description of that, that'd be great. Or somehow point me to the consolidated version of it. But I can definitely confirm again. I should have done this before. The aspiration of an urban growth boundary is a defensible edge. And you're dealing with one that can become your township. And if I can just refresh myself on the definition of urban growth boundary, it means a boundary shown on a plan match provide for and contains existing and future development within an urban area. The defensible edge for the Hawea community was Century Road, and you're saying would have been the marine, potentially that's, and I'm not going to hold you to that because obviously I'm about to get back to, and it's gone down below, and now we're pushing across Cemetery Road, notwithstanding that the SHA has no actual bearing in terms of how we're looking at that. And we're saying that our defensible edges, and this is what I'm trying to get clear in my head for standing in front of the Halvia Community Association and describing to them how this is happening, is a water race and a cadastral boundary. And I am struggling, and this is what I was trying to ask Ms. Gilbert, to understand how those can be defensible edges. And if you then, with reference to that blue triangle, which is the street property that extends past that defensible edge, are we actually just saying, with reference to Ms. Gilbert's point yesterday about it, should it be the Halvia River? So are we actually saying there is no defensible edge and there is no open growth boundary?
In this context, my answer is that the Cemetery Road edge is weak, and this is an opportunity to create a better and defensible urban edge. And the urban edge is weak because when you apply a proposal to modify it against chapter 4 and chapter 6 of the plan, there aren't the costs of extending it into that area are not so high that Cemetery Road forms a good proxy or a good defendable urban growth boundary. It's not, I mean, if the Halvia River, for whatever reason, became incised and bordered the land, that might be a reason. You know, if the Halvia River was there and it was a boundary of an ONF, that would be a much different conversation about not extending an urban growth boundary to the edge of that. And even if you did, you'd have to have a setback because there's policies in the plan that require to have consideration of development in proximity to ONFs and ONLs. The flood hazards aren't telling us that it's somewhere where urban development shouldn't be extended. And the productive soil resource, there is a productive soil resource, but it's not high enough to use Cemetery Road as the urban growth boundary.
And so if I was to accept that Cemetery Road is not defensible edge, it's not good enough defensible edge, is the water risk?
The water risk can be, and I am relying on Ms. Gilbert's evidence for that, in terms of how it can be augmented and built upon to be 15 metres wide, and whether or not if it's permanently or intermittently flowing isn't a deal breaker. It's about what that becomes.
And when she was pushed yesterday with regard to, well, water races can become pipes, so the water can still flow, and because water's a bit like firewood, people get really upset about it. That happens, then what we're dealing with is trees. And trees, as a defensible edge or a landscape feature, are impermanent.
Yes, you're right. And mounding, and what will probably, I've heard from Mr. Williams' evidence, and I don't have a problem with that either, is it'll probably become a council reserve. And for that reason, it'll probably become quite an important sort of community walkway, accessway, sort of connection node between Halvia Flat and Halvia Township.
And I fully accept all that, but Lismore Park is a community facility, it's not the edge of Wanaka.
Yep, there's lots of parks within and on the edge of urban areas.
I get that, but as a defensible, I'm pushing for an urban growth boundary, and if you look at part C of the consolidated version, have community support as expressed. So do we end up with community supporting the water race as a defensible edge, establishing an urban growth boundary, and then you and I sitting here in 20 years' time, well, I hope I will be, I know you will be, and having the same discussion.
Mm.
And with that in mind, in terms of the cadastral boundary on the east, well, is potentially even something like the land use classifications that we use, is that a stronger edge than a cadastral boundary?
Well, it could be. It would be, especially in light of what might central government might deliver in terms of a national policy statement on productive soils. As you're asking me these questions, I don't have a new answer for you, but what I am thinking is, and I am, Ms. Scott sitting next to me, so she can shake her head or not, but perhaps what might help augment the, if this extension were to occur, would be perhaps some specific location-specific policies with greater specificity than what has been where Policy 23 has been amended to in Chapter 4 that says this is the edge of Lake Hawea Township, this is the sort of southern extent of it, and it is here for these reasons. And if it is ever extended, because district plans have to be able to contemplate
Absolutely.
Change, it needs to, perhaps these are the reasons why it could be extended, or these are, this is the sort of parameters or how it might extend, and that would help rather than just relying on a new defendable edge for the sake of it and it becoming a physical edge, if there's, in the future, if there's a plan change or another plan review, 15 years, that would be the time to revisit that and you've actually got something to build upon rather than sort of somebody saying we can just build another urban edge and we think it's a good idea and it's time to extend it.
And which is my small concern with the little blue triangle.
Yeah.
Is we've already exceeded. And that was the same, and I vividly remember the SAP discussion.
Yeah.
And around the street development, which was already across. And I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that we dig a trench, put towers around it, heavy machine guns, and defend it to the last breath. But it just needs from.
I hear what you're saying in terms of your questions you're putting to me, and I think if limb C of policy 22 isn't, it's one policy limb. It's one policy limb in the balance of the whole district plan, and you know, clearly I don't think this proposal can achieve that. You can easily also criticise that the council haven't done enough in terms of updating the community plan since 2003, but I think if there were some provisions in Chapter 4 of the plan that would provide better substance as to if another change is contemplated through a private plan change or some other change in the future, then there's some there's something that the has, wouldn't say has some more teeth, but it certainly has some parameters around it. And I think maybe Arrowtown, the, you know, the location specific policies for Arrowtown might have that sort of flavour to them because of the.
And I'll point you to the SHA and say Arrowtown as well.
Oh yeah.
Let's not even go there. The and I'm not.
Before you go on, Commissioner, can I ask the question that's lurking in my mind? Do we have scope to fiddle with Chapter 4?
Is that a question to me or is Scott?
Well, you can choose. I just toss it quietly in the in your combined direction.
We might just catch that question and have to think about it.
I understand.
It's not a, it's quite a
yes.
Big question, I think, in the context of what we're talking about today.
Okay, Commissioner McLeod, carry on, please, while Ms. Scott thinks about it.
I think I expressed my concerns, and I'm not expecting you to suddenly change your opinion and write me a defensive urban growth boundary statement. We'll move on. With regard to infrastructure, and what discussion in my head, and I apologize. you come back to me?
Well, Mr. Dawson, if you care to talk to
Okay. I don't, Mr. Bauer, I presume you didn't have a lot of time to work on these provisions.
No.
No. I mean, and you've, I mean, thank you for giving it a go. And I mean, I fully understand that trying to write provisions that capture all the things that might be needed should this development go ahead, given that it's a controlled activity subdivision, that we need to get the provisions into the plan. But is it fair to say that there could be some ongoing work needed to these provisions, in your view? I mean, you were going to actually tell us about some additional thoughts you'd have. Was that what you were going
to
say?
I was going to run through at least the mechanics of the affordable housing provision, but
maybe I'll just run through the sorts of concerns I have, and they'll just be representative concerns.
Yep. Sure.
I mean, in paragraphs 353 and 354, you talk about how can we bring the implications of the special housing area over into the plan provisions, and you talk about one option being some deferred zoning other than the SHA, and that's getting complex and fraught with implementation problems. So I accept that. And so your second option is the second option the one that you've started to flesh out in the provisions that you've put to us?
Yes.
Which is to try and bring over the affordability housing contribution as a requirement across the whole of the new area, given that it can't necessarily be targeted just to the SHA area.
Well, one of the reasons for that is Section 32 reason, and it's picking up on the submitter's evidence around the benefits that would be accrued from a rezoning in a greenfield area in terms of housing choices and a variety of housing. So my recommendation is that if this is granted, then it's to sort of see that through and take it a step further by ensuring there's a component of affordable provision for affordable housing made, and that would certainly deal with what seems to be the case for the Queenstown Lakes District and also the Upper Clutha, in that you have if there's a sort of constraint in terms of if you're using price points as a constraint for an issue, there certainly seems to be a constraint for housing or lots at the lower end of the market spectrum.
Yes, I mean, in Ms. Hanson's evidence, if there is a need or a lack of capacity or potential lack of capacity, it's at that lower price point.
That's right.
And doesn't appear in the total numbers, but can appear in the lack of at that point.
Yeah.
And you say here that you consider that it's consistent with Mr. Williams' evidence, where he supports the rezoning on the basis that it can be a benefit to an underperforming housing supply market.
Yes.
At that level.
Yes.
Okay, so let's just look. I mean, it does get tricky to implement, though. But no, so just coming back one point, you've suggested that whatever is required be spread across the whole of the rezoning as opposed to the SHA part of it.
Yeah, and yeah, that could be commensurately more than what the deed or whatever the agreement is, but I don't care. Section 32 is, I think there's a good reason under Section 32 to provide affordability across the whole rezoned area. I'm sorry, I didn't mean I don't care. I think that the Section 32 benefits of providing that outweigh the costs.
Okay. So work. I mean, it starts off in the low density zone with your new rule 7.4.A, as I understand it, which says that any residential activity that has not implemented the affordable housing provisions.
And the infrastructure rule as well.
And the infrastructure rules,
yep.
Yes, is a non-compliant activity.
Yeah.
So how can the residential activity can't implement those? It's the subdivision or something that's happened before the residential activity comes along that would implement it. I mean, a house can't implement an intersection upgrade.
No, these are essentially backstop rules, and I wondered whether or not to recommend them at all. But hypothetically, if the land zoned low density residential, you can build. You do have a permitted baseline, and is it fanciful to say I'm doing 500 permitted lots? Probably you'd need roading, you'd need infrastructure, but it's a really a backstop rule that somebody doesn't think they can circumvent the subdivision, the obligation under the subdivision.
Would it be better expressed on a timing basis, create a condition precedent? Any residential activity that occurs in circumstances where those rules have not yet been implemented.
Yeah, that's that what you intend?
Yes.
That you can't have a residential activity as permitted, it becomes non-compliant if those provisions haven't been implemented.
Yes.
Okay, that's all right. That's good to know. So this, and that's just a backstop if there's no subdivision.
Yes.
Because the subdivision rules are to be created to implement those provisions.
Yes, and it's. For, I guess, the main landowner, the key landowner who owns the bulk of land, but in particular the sites at the western extent that are on quite small lots, they could, if the rezoning happens, I mean, I know they can build as a permitted activity under the rural residential zoning provisions, but there'd be a, if there's a policy, let's say these policies happen and the rules happen and there's a policy requiring an intersection upgrade, but that landowner goes and develops and builds then and undermines the ability for land to be taken, because I think from what I've learnt from Mr. Smith, the reality is that the site on the west, that the development yield's going to go down because land's going to be taken for an intersection improvement. So they could build as of right and that would seem to be undermine all the provisions.
So this would stop that?
Well, it would create
a
non-compliant.
Someone coming along with a residential activity that doesn't require subdivision from starting to build before all these works are done, or even in the case of that intersection standing in the way if the work's ever been done.
That's correct.
So that, but as you say, it's a sort of backstop rule.
Yeah.
Would this override the zoning, the permitted activities in the current rural residential zone?
Yes, it's an activity rule.
Yes.
So it'd be...
Once that zoning's changed, if it does get changed, becomes operative, which might be years away yet, they would lose their right to have permitted activities under the rural residential and would be caught by this rule on those, even though those lots are already subdivided.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would.
Fine.
It would apply, yes.
Yep.
And I've, yeah.
That's fine. So then... We've got some policies and objectives, which I won't go through in any detail, relating to the structure plan. But they are the policies and objectives that set out what's to be provided on the structure plan. I mean, we don't have a structure plan yet, but for this set of rules to be implementable whole, it would need to have a structure plan as part of that.
Yes.
So it's not something that comes along at a later date.
No.
Like it did it.
No, it would be added
here
to the plan.
It's got to be in the plan.
Yes.
And we don't have that yet.
That's right.
All right. So, but for us to make a decision, we'd need to have something in front of us.
Yes.
All right. And what do these policies do? What's the point of all these policies under the heading structure plan? Do they just deal with what the structure plan? They seem to go into infrastructure contributions.
They do. They're quite. I can run through them at a high level, and you can come back to me on any particular issues.
Well, no. I just want. Are you muddling structure plan issues and infrastructure contributions and upgrades in this set of not muddling but combining?
No, I'm not muddling, but I'm combining the policies under one heading because the way the structure of the subdivision chapter is that there's a a section for location-specific policies.
And they all call structure plan as their heading?
Not necessarily. Perhaps there could be subheadings. So there could be, within the policies themselves, there could be subheadings that say structure plan and integrated development, then another subheading that says infrastructure, and another subheading that says affordable housing.
I mean, I only say that because I got a bit muddled, because the overall heading above the objective says it's to do with the structure plan.
That's right, okay.
And then it's, and I'm thinking, well, these infrastructure objectives are not going to be implemented through the structure plan. They're actually additional requirements.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so I think that's fine as long as...
Yeah.
So this is where the policies sit, which need to be quite specific, because they form the basis of conditions that will be imposed at the time of subdivision.
Yes, and they also relate to the subdivision achieving a certain environmental standard with the subdivision and development works as well,
like
the creation of the creation of what is the urban growth boundary. And yeah.
But because those are not just policies, they're important policies. Yeah. What's to be achieved through each of those policies also needs to find a home in the matters of control.
Yes.
So is that what 27.7a onwards are they all?
Yes.
Because I just haven't got the provisions of the subdivision in front of me. Are they all just matters of control, or are they standards?
But in addition, so I did add in, or perhaps Mr. Williams added in as a placeholder, on page 29. There's rule 27.7.1, which is the generic.
Yes.
PDP rule for controlled activities for subdivision.
Yes.
With consistent with the structure plan. There's the matters of control, and then in addition, so any subdivision and development would be subject to those controls, those matters of control.
Yes, which is the 27.7a.
Oh no, 27.7.1, and then in addition.
So 27.7.1 is the other generic one.
Yes.
And then in addition,
yes,
you've got, in addition to the matters of control under 27.7.1, you've got ABC,
yes,
on that page, which are additional matters of control for Hawea South. I mean, I'm not looking at the detail of them.
Yep, that's right. That's
and they do they need to relate to all the matters from the policies that would need to be achieved through,
not,
or between 1 and 1A? NA, all the matters in the policies that would need to be achieved through conditions on subdivision consent?
No, because, not necessarily, because you have the matters, there's a little bit of duplication in them, but sometimes it's emphasising the importance. The matters of control in Rule 27.7.1 are relevant, and there's assessment matters for those in the subdivision chapter. So if there's matter of control and assessment matter that generically says open space network or walkways and cycleways, clearly you've got guidance in the structure plan and more specific policies as to what the end outcome should be. But for Rule 27.7a, I don't know if you need to have a matter of control for every element in the policies that you want to see brought through.
As long as it's also already covered in,
yes,
one.
That's right, and perhaps, I mean...
Okay.
But I mean, A, B, C, there is an element of repetition between those two, but perhaps it's sort of emphasising and reinforcing.
The ones that are different or more significant for this.
They will be
area.
On the structure. They would be identified on a structure plan, so they need to be just emphasising that they are important aspects.
Well, they're not all, and they don't mean they're not all on the sub. They're not all relating to the subdivision on the what's shown on the structure plan, are they?
Well, there isn't a structure plan at the moment. That's a. Yeah, my evidence had a zoning plan, and it did sort of couch the fact that a structure plan would need to be created.
Yes, but things like B, which are the infrastructure upgrades with respect to water,
yes, you're right.
They go beyond the structure plan.
Yes, sorry,
they're
you're right.
Actual things that are
that's correct.
Conditions.
Yep,
yes.
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so then I got into a bit of numbering-ish problem. What are on page 31? These are no longer matters of control, are they? Or are they are those standards?
So rule 27A2 and limbs A to C are exemptions. Well, not exemptions, they are standards to help determine compliance.
Yes, so the numbering should be across in the left-hand column. So that's a sort of like counter to 27.7.1, which says subdivision consistent with the structure plan is controlled.
Yes.
But any subdivision, and I don't know what it says for other areas, if you're not consistent with the structure plan, you just discretionary or something.
Depends. It's not.
Each one has their own.
Discretionary,
okay, but
or
in
Howie's
case, we're going to have a separate rule
that
says any subdivision that's inconsistent with this structure plan is non-compliant.
Yes.
And then A, B here and C are part of that rule.
Yes, and you could have.
And when you use the word permitted, you mean allowed or.
Yes, and they could be. Sometimes they're alternatively identified on the structure plan itself and allow for deviations
and tolerances.
But
that's part of a rule.
Often they're like notes on the structure plan.
So what happens if they haven't, you might come to this, but what happens if they don't provide, if there are no infrastructure upgrades? So we haven't got room, we haven't got Project Pure connected to Hawea. Mr. Powell said that there's no plan to provide for this area, no funding for it.
It's a good point. So you
still
got
in a matter of control, we've got infrastructure upgrades.
Mm.
So how do we? Where's the 500 lots?
So that goes into rules. rule on page 33. Good point there. I mean, the tension you're probably identifying is that you could have a controlled activity and a policy that asks for a very large infrastructure sort of.
Yeah,
but there's also
which is unable to be achieved.
Which is rule 27.7A7 refers to.
Okay, so that rule overrides 27.7.1.
Yes, it would.
Just like 27.7A2 would override it if they tried to do something inconsistent with the structure plan.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm starting to understand it. So this rule is a rule that said you can have up to 500 lots before you've implemented something called 27.7A4.
That's policy, and that probably comes back to the.
But that's just a. What's that? That's just a policy. Where's 27.7A4? That's affordable housing.
Yes, that's a mistake. That should. The intent, which you have identified, is that it shouldn't be 27.7A4, that's an error. It should refer, cross-reference back to the policy on infrastructure. So it should refer to policy 27.3X4, which is on page 28.
Because beside that I've got, where is this implemented?
Yes, good question.
So how do you have a rule which says you've got to implement a policy? How do you write the policy out as a rule? Policy following approval of subdivision of 500 residential lots or prior to this ensure that any further subdivision makes a contribution. Isn't that pretty weak? I mean, given the level of doubt, I mean, they might pay a couple of dollars.
It is placing the policy in the hands of perhaps whatever agreement might.
Which we don't have.
Brokered at the time of the future consent between what the developer thinks is what the subdivider thinks is appropriate versus, I guess, the wider infrastructure.
Well, my concern is that given the doubt that we have about availability of infrastructure, whether it's roading, water or sewage, is that rule that just says you've got to implement a policy, which is in itself is fairly general, strong enough to be the sort of key thing that triggers whether further subdivision over 500 lots can happen or not?
Perhaps not. I think the key phrase there is makes a contribution. This needs to be looked at.
You're almost starting to write rules in the policies in order to be able to implement them through the rules, and that doesn't seem like a normal way around. I'm not saying that the policy is necessarily wrong as a policy. What I'm saying is that the implementation of that, usually the detail of the implementation of that, would normally be written as part of a rule rather than making the policy more specific.
Okay. Thank you. I'll think about that.
Given that there is so much uncertainty about whether or not these upgrades can actually be achieved or not and how much they might cost.
Yes.
So I sort of have similar, my net concern about the affordable housing provisions. I mean, I haven't really looked at them in detail, but we've now got a rule headed up affordable housing in the subdivision section, which says subdivision and development that has more than 3 lots or units and provides affordable housing. Tell me how this works.
I'd love to, yep.
Do you have to actually start back with 5 and 6, which
are? Yep, so the intention of these provisions are to provide, that the housing choices for low to moderate income households, that they're incorporated into this subdivision. So you have policies 27, 3, 5, 6, 7, and 8. 6 is the overarching policy, you could say. Policy 7 is more of a detailed performance outcome policy.
How?
Yep, it happens. And Policy 8 is a policy which is an alternative, effectively, and that's if the developer were to identify or make a contribution towards the provision of affordable lots outside the development site, then there's a discretionary activity status that allows for that contemplation.
Okay, all right, so that's fine. As a concept. If you then turn to 27.7A5 and A6, sort of as the, I think it's helpful for me to start there because that's the sort of bottom line ones.
The key
or
implementing
or maybe four.
Three. Well, you have a controlled activity rule 27.7A3 on page 31 is a controlled activity rule. And the key thing there is that it says subdivision and development, and it only identifies the low and medium density zones of this development, not the local shopping centre, even though it provides for residential. And then the threshold is 3 residential units.
So any subdivision
3 lots,
that
sorry.
Contains three, more than 3 lots, and provides affordable housing in accordance with the schedule.
No, with the rule. So the next rule is which is effectively a standard, but because of the sort of structure of the the location specific subdivision rules, it's sitting as a rule next to it, but it's okay. So the, and then you've got control, and so if you comply with
is 27.74A4 really part of A3? The standard that sits within?
Yes, that's right. It's the key. It's the sort of key determinant of how it's going to be realised.
So subdivision that meets A4 is controlled, and subdivision that doesn't meet A4 is discretionary.
That's right.
I think that could be. I do think that the mixing of standard and subdivision activity status gets a bit. Because, I mean, A4 is written as a standard about what should be provided for affordable housing.
Yes.
It doesn't actually say that if you don't provide it at subdivision, you're a discretionary.
Okay.
You see what I mean? Like, shouldn't the standard come as part of A3? Like, if you provide the following, you're controlled, and these are the matters that control is reserved for, and all A4 needs to say, if you don't, you're discretionary.
Yes, I understand.
Because otherwise you're saying, oh, anyway.
No, I hear you. That's good.
Yeah.
Yep, that's
okay.
That's helpful. Thanks. So then, I think you know standard 4 is the sort of key standard there.
Yes, because I got concerned because suddenly we're talking about standards about houses, whereas this is actually a standard about subdivision. It's, I mean, it's a rule about subdivision, not a. So if you make A4 to be subdivision that doesn't provide the housing in A3, then you're keeping your rules related to subdivision as opposed to bringing in a rule that looks like it's related to housing.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so tell me about A4. How that standard works.
It provides three options for how the affordability component or provision is going to be undertaken, and it effectively provides three options for the subdivider set out in LIMS.
So where did this come from? I mean, has this been used elsewhere?
No, not yet.
So it hasn't been used in any other zone or in SHA or anything?
No.
Oh, well done. Yeah, so this is all new.
The council are working on
a plan change, a stage that.
All I can really say at this stage is the council are working on what is destined to be a very popular affordable housing district-wide chapter in the district plan.
And even on the council's website it says that could potentially be part of stage 4.
That's right. Mm. But at this point in time I can't say that these provisions reflect what may or may not happen as a result of that.
Is there any policy support for these provisions in the plan as a whole?
Chapter 3 has provision, there are some quite broad objectives in Chapter 3 which look very close to sort of Part 2 of the Act in terms of community well-being. But at the moment, it's limited to those relatively broad provisions in Chapter 3.
Okay. Which is why you need to. Which is why you would therefore really need to support these in the objectives and policies of this for this area.
That's right. That's why they're located as a consequence of this, that are unique at the moment to this rezoning proposal.
And your argument is that's consistent with the Section 32 for this.
Yes,
for
and there's.
Which Section 32? What Section 32?
No, I'm saying from a Section 32 perspective, there's support. Yes, there is in terms of also when considering the costs and benefits and of the supporting the proposal. What I'm saying there is that both myself and Mr. Williams' evidence discusses the.
So really the Section 32 support comes through your evidence and Mr. Williams'
evidence. That's right.
Because it's not strongly supported by Ms. Hampson's evidence.
No, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. All right, and it's not strongly supported by any other provisions in the plan?
Apart from some broad provisions in Chapter 3.
Community well-being or whatever. Yeah. Okay. And Mr. Williams' evidence links back to the housing capacity development assessment and the lack of the potential issue with low-cost housing being sufficiently provided. Is that
Yes, potentially, and there's also support for this. I think there's support for this in the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity.
Okay. All right. Okay. So just so now, just take me and tell me what 5 and 6 are. 27.7a.5 and 27.6. Shouldn't it say subdivision that doesn't provide affordable housing in accordance with these standards in the site is discretionary? You've got a series of standards here that apply to subdivision in Hawea South. You've got a standard that says that affordable housing needs to be provided in this way. You've got a standard that says it needs to be provided for in the development site. You've got a standard that says that you can't have more than 500 lots unless you get your infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You've got a standard about staging. I mean, you could just, I don't know, just think about the, I think you've got to be, because these are really important and they need to be sort of clear as a bell as to how they're to be implemented. Can't have any muddle between residential development and subdivision, between standards and matters of control. So I suppose at a conceptual basis, that was my problem, was that I found this all quite muddled in terms of its structure of writing. And
that's good. That's good feedback.
Is that all right?
Yeah, sure.
Can you understand what I'm on about?
I think so.
Okay.
Mr. Barr's defence, he did do this quite quickly.
Well, I asked him that to start with. I said, Mr. Barr, you must have done this quite quickly, and he didn't say yes. He looked like he was under control.
That's because we've been happily loading weight on Mr. Barr's shoulders, and he's been taking it like a man.
I know. I gave him the opportunity to say, oh, yes, I rushed these. I'm really sorry they aren't that good. Can you just give me any hints you've got to improve them? But he didn't say that at all.
That's Mr. Barr's approach, but he was under a lot of pressure.
All right. Well, just learn that when the opportunity is available to release yourself of pressure, take it.
It's okay. I'm engaged with what you're saying. I don't need to apologise for them.
All right. And then, I mean, I haven't looked at the detail of these schedules, but if I was to...
Oh, you should. Yeah.
Well, I'm saying to you, if I was to, they will need to be rock solid as standards, because that's what they are.
Yes.
A4, A5, A6, A7, and the schedules, they are rules.
Yes.
And they have, yes. You have to know whether they're implemented or not. And so there can't be anything that looks like a condition of a subdivision consent. And that would be another thing that I'm always on about, is that standards in a plan are not written like conditions of subdivision consent. Because they have to apply to whatever comes along, and there can be no discretion. Right, that's probably enough for me to, for Mr. Williams and you. But I'm sure the Commissioner Hill is has exactly the same sort of skill set that I have.
That's good advice. Thank you. I'll think about that, Commissioner.
Mr. Hill, may have some more.
Well, the only, I don't think I've got any more to add to it. I just wondered whether you had worked through a theoretical application of this and how it actually looked in reality. Maybe with your consent team. Because, as I said, it's a very comprehensive set of provisions. And I also agree, Commissioner Dawson, that I get confused by the standards which have this activity status. But what I would like to see, and I'm not saying you should do this, you almost need to see how this is actually working in practice to make sure the provisions actually work. I agree with Mr. Dawson, they need to be very clear and precise, I think, to make it work. So I don't know whether that kind of exercise has been done, say, with your consenting team.
Not through the lens of this proposal, given the 2 days I had. But I think a key, yes, that's something I was thinking about as I was adopting them or including them in this, and sort of obviously modifying them for the purposes of this development. I think a key thing there is the 3 units as a threshold, which is relatively low. But in terms of how it would work mechanically, yes, that's good advice. I'll bear that in mind as well.
Maybe at time. I mean, I think it would be. Yeah. I think it would be a useful exercise. Well,
Mr. Williams might
help. Yeah,
exactly.
I have a larger question. To what extent, if any, have you canvassed with Mr. Williams the concepts that you've worked through in this plan? Or put another way, can we expect the inimitable form of Mr. Todd to stomp in and tell us that this is absolutely outrageous and we can't possibly even entertain provisions of this ilk?
I'm kind of
looking forward to that.
I haven't had a conversation with Mr. Williams about it yet. I mean, Mr. Williams might have an alternative. He might have an alternative that maybe more directly aligns the issues around the obligation under the SHA as well.
Okay, understand.
I mean, given the lack of clear policy support for this sort of affordable housing provision in the plan as yet, it's starting to demand submitter support for it to go into the plan for this area in particular. Maybe not, but maybe you need to tell us that there's enough support in there for it.
The support comes back to the support for ensuring a variety of housing. As a spouse to Mr. Williams' evidence and as in the NPS UDC, and probably comes back to the sort of tension, if there's any tension at all, that I have with between my evidence and Ms. Hampson's around there, and also the Ms. Devlin's 42A report and the Section 32 as well, that says there's sufficient capacity in Hawera at the moment. So I don't see it as needing a wider PDP support. I think it comes back to the context of this first scheduled process on its, or this plan change, or this rezoning submission on its own, and a justification on its merits.
The evidence that's been brought.
Yes.
Time is rolling on, and it's Friday, so
yep.
Can.
No, obviously, I don't have the planning skill set, fellow commissioners, but I'd just like to commend you for coming up with the concept and a novel test, I'm sure. Mr. Dawson will have more. Just wondering, when you came to the financial contributions to council as 27A4 and you had 10 and 5%, what was the difference for those?
It's a good solid number.
Nice round numbers.
Yep. I think it's in line. I think the SHA is, I'm not sure what the council's lead policy is on the SHA. It's not something, not a topic I can involve with much.
10%.
The SHA
was 5%.
It was 5%. I thought it was 10.
No, it was doubled to 10.
Doubled to 10.
At a meeting, and there was all sort of conniptions about potential kickback. No one mentioned a thing. So the point I was going to make is,
Mr. Williams' evidence might have been, I could be wrong, he'll correct me, but I understand it was 12.5% for the Hawea SHA.
The Hawea. So that's potentially, that was the question, the 10 and 5, maybe we're pushing it too low. Also, how did you get to 40 square metres? That's a heck of a floor area.
Oh, is this for the tiny house? Where's that provision, Commissioner?
For 47A4, for the purpose of this rule, residential units less than 40 square metres of floor area shall not be counted as contributing to the total number of residential units.
It's just in case there's some sort of tiny house provision made for tiny houses, which are separate residential units, but if there's any of that, it's unlikely because of the nature and of the subdivision you'd get. You'd probably get, because it's greenfield, you get a fee simple configuration. So.
And also, final point, affordability, is that a definition? Should that go into definitions? Because that's a question that gets asked consistently.
Well, I wouldn't put affordability into the definition in the PDP as a consequence of this rezoning, but it's identified in part five of the these provisions in the schedule.
Totally get that, but it's there's a good definition. Would it then flow on to the definition section? Definition group, the group of definitions?
At this point, I'd say it's best kept with these provisions. Perhaps it's something for the future.
That's me. Well done.
Can I just ask one last quick question? Where did the 500 allotments for the infrastructure contributions come from?
Well, even though I've said that I don't support the, I don't sort of acknowledge or accept that SHA forms part of the existing environment from a planning perspective, from an infrastructure perspective, I understand that the council have, well, there's the effect of 500 lots on infrastructure. That the council, from Mr. Powell's perspective, must have anticipated to happen, or if not Mr. Powell, the commissioners
so
on the resource consent.
Is the
SHA.
It's about 400.
No,
yeah, it's 400
okay.
And something, but I rounded it up to 500.
Right. But is your overarching recommendation still that this rezoning be rejected on
yes.
the basis that there isn't any clear provision for sewage or water supply?
Yes, and that's on Mr. Mr. Powell's yep. evidence. But obviously, the hearings panel, where you have an option to use the provisions, to support or accept the rezoning, but subject to the provisions, which would hopefully subject to the conversation, the questions you asked about the effectiveness of the policy and the rule to make sure that happens. But there is also an alternative to ensure that even though there isn't the infrastructure right now and it's not in the plan, that
yes,
even
so
though you
that
can.
That was my question, my Final question. Is it intended that this non-complying rule about the 500 lots linked to the policy, which could be a rule,
yeah.
it could be in the rule,
yeah.
saying what it means, what, is that intended to overcome your recommend, if that works and you can have up to 500 as a right, but beyond that, non-complying, unless all these things are sorted out, that's intended to overcome your recommendation to reject
yes.
it outright.
Yes.
Yeah, as a way around that.
Yes.
Okay. So if that's the case, then it really does further strengthen my concern that what it is that needs to be met to not become non-complying needs to be crystal clear, not left to the interpretation of a policy.
So effectively, stage triggering rules.
It's a staging
rules. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because that's what you're really intending, is that 500, okay, but beyond that, all the things that I'm currently concerned, you're currently, Mr. Powell, are concerned about, and possibly in the road as well, need to be resolved, or you can't move on.
Yes, understood.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barr. Although you didn't take the opportunity to emphasise the extent of the hospital pass that you got.
Just timing. It wasn't a hospital pass, it was just
taking over. We do appreciate the extent to which you have gone to try and analyse the issues, find solutions and suggest how they might be put together. We'll see if Universal has a similar view, but in the fullness of time. Ms. Scott, I think we should hear Ms. Bavaya's summary, at least, before we break for lunch. Because come hell or high water, we are finishing this afternoon.
Just to let you know, I don't have any questions to Ms. Bavaya.
Hey, is that a promise?
Yes, no, not. But I don't have any written down. It's recorded. Just to make sure you have the right paper in front of you, we have section 42A and one rebuttal statement. And hopefully a summary as well. The PDP settlement zone replaces the operative township zone and is proposed to apply to the settlements of Makarora, Luggett, Glenorchy, Kinloch and Kingston. Codrona is currently zoned operative rural visitor zone and is also proposed to be zoned settlement zone in the PDP. Albertown and Hawea are currently zoned operative township zone and are proposed to be zoned lower density suburban residential zone. The settlement zone predominantly provides for low-density residential activities with provision for commercial and visitor accommodation activities in commercial precincts and visitor accommodation subzones shown on the planning maps. Residential development provided for in the settlement zone predominantly comprises detached single-storey dwellings on spacious sites with low building coverage. My key recommended changes to the notified provisions are briefly summarised as follows. A. Amending notified objective 20.2.1 and policies 20.2.1.1 and 20.2.2.1 and 20.2.2.2 to replace the word intensity with density. B. Amending notified policy 20.2.2.6 and adding a new advice note in 20.3.3 regarding electricity sub-transmission infrastructure and compliance with the Electrical Code of Practice for Safe Distances. C. Amending notified rule 20.5.3 to exclude associated office, storage, staff room and bathroom activities from the calculation of gross floor area of retail and office activities located in a commercial precinct. D. Amending notified rule 20.5.10 to provide greater flexibility for heavy vehicles to be parked overnight on sites within commercial precincts and visitor accommodation subzones. And E. Amending rule 30.5.6.6 of Chapter 30, Energy and Utilities, to provide for telecommunications poles up to 15 metre high in the commercial precinct at Codrona as a permitted activity, subject to compliance with rules for height recession plans, setbacks, maximum head frame and antenna dimension, and maximum light reflectance value. In relation to the key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and submitters who have filed evidence, the following key matters remain in contention. A. Telecommunication poles heights in the commercial precinct at Codrona, whereby Mr. Horn for Spark New Zealand Limited and Vodafone seeks a maximum permitted height of 18 metres for poles with co-located antennas. B. The rule framework for education facilities in the settlement zone, whereby Mr. Prince for the Ministry of Education seeks that the National Planning Standards definition of education facility be included in Chapter 2 definitions, and that education facilities are provided for as a restricted discretionary activity in areas of the settlement zone located outside of a commercial precinct, rather than as a discretionary activity pursuant to notified rule 20.4.13. C. The site-specific provisions sought by Mr. Grace for Kingston Lifestyle Properties Limited and Codrona Village Limited, which generally seek to add greater flexibility to the settlement zone provisions for the submission sites at Kingston and Codrona. D. The site-specific provisions sought by Mr. Williams for Quartz Commercial Group Limited, which generally seek to add greater flexibility to the lower density suburban residential zone provisions for the submission site at Hawea. And E, the relief sought by Mr. Farrell for Wayfair Limited and Codrona Alpine Resort Limited to introduce an enabling framework for worker accommodation in the settlement zone. And finally, the Lake Mackay Partnership Rezoning, which is submission 3196. Regarding Lake Mackay Partnership, as the outstanding matter related to infrastructure has now been resolved through evidence exchange, I recommend at section 8 of my rebuttal that the rezoning be accepted in part, with the amendments outlined at section 13 of my evidence in chief. I note that these amendments are supported by Mr. Curley for the submitter at pages 2 to 4 of Mr. Curley's evidence.
I also note that the rezoning is opposed by Queenstown Airport Corporation. I have one additional in relation to Lake Mackay. I was here yesterday and heard Mr. Jones speak. And I have spoken to Mr. Jones around the northern part of that site, and I can talk to that perhaps when you've got questions on it, or I can touch on it now, just in terms of the zone boundary treatment or lack thereof in the recommended provisions.
Why don't you hold that thought, and we'll deal with that first thing after lunch.
Okay.
So we'll adjourn, come back at, well, as close to 1:15 as we can.